A friend of mine who lives and works in Newcastle recently set off into the big shopping mall armed with simple questionnaires and a handful of friends. The principal question they posed to passers-by was very simple. What do you think is the purpose of life? They received various replies. One man said, well, we're here to carry on the human race, aren't we? Which is a sort of biological answer. Another rather world-weary guy said, I sometimes wake up and feel I'm only here to pay the bills. And next came a bunch of cheery teenagers who said, it's all about enjoying life and having fun. So presumably their bills were already being paid by someone else, maybe even by the dad of one of them, having spoken just moments before. As I say, they received a variety of answers. But what really surprised the questioner was the number of people who, when asked what is the meaning of life, said, I've really no idea at all. Earlier this autumn, the novelist and broadcaster Will Self undertook a more sophisticated version of that exercise, and he recorded the outcome in a series of radio programs entitled Self's Search for Meaning. In episode one, he spoke to scientists, who said that scientific progress is what gives life its meaning. In episode two, he spoke to philosophers who apparently said that since the 20th century, they really felt unable to comment. Neither answer did a lot for him, so he turned, hopefully in episode three, to what he called people of faith. But they too left him disappointed. And Will Self, much like my friend up north, said that what really surprised and bothered him was just how very inadequate most people's answers were to the question. Now, suppose he had asked you the same question about the purpose of life. How would you have replied? Many people seem to assume that a Christian answer to the question would be something along these lines. It's about trying a bit harder and living a bit better. Believing in God, yes, signing up to Christian values, keeping to the rules at least some of the time, coming to church when you can make it, and with a bit of luck, when your life has run its course, you will end up in a better place. Now, there are many variations on that theme, but broadly speaking, that is how Christianity is often perceived. People can therefore be very surprised when they look into the Christian faith, read some of the New Testament documents, which they may not have done since childhood, if at all, and find that it is actually saying something completely different, in fact, almost the opposite of what they expected. Because Christian thinking really has very little to do with you and me, what we should do, how we should live on a Monday morning or whatever. It is rather about Jesus Christ, who he is, why he came, and why his coming should be enormously significant for you and for me. Now, the Apostle John was one of the original witnesses to Jesus. He was in that little band of followers known as the disciples. He knew Jesus well. And writing later in life, he expresses his deepest conviction in this way, and I quote, "We know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding that we may know him who is true." We know that the Son of God has come. What are we to make of that description of Jesus as the Son of God? Well, one of the first people to use the term, strangely enough, was a thick-skinned Roman centurion. We don't know his name or anything about him. What we do know is his role in the crucifixion of Jesus. It was this guy's job to make sure that this supposed criminal was efficiently and finally dispatched to an early grave like no shortage of others who had met the same fate at the hand of the Romans. But something about this particular prisoner, charged with insurrection as king of the Jews, was strangely different. His whole deportment, and especially the manner of his death, spoke of something very unusual, in fact, unique, going on in that gruesome scene. The brutality, the cursing, the swearing, the desperate and agonized cries of the crucified, these are things with which the centurion would have been all too familiar. But the gospel narratives, unlike Mel Gibson's film of The Passion, are very restrained. They avoid all the gory details, but they do tell us this, that when this tough Roman soldier saw how Jesus died, he could not help saying out loud, "This man really was the Son of God." Now, he didn't have a degree in theology. If you'd been there and had asked him exactly what he meant by what he said, he might have found it hard to explain. But the thought he is surely trying to express is that this Jesus was no ordinary man, that he cannot be explained, as you and I can, in merely human terms. That to look at him and to listen to him as he did and to watch him as he did in life and in death is nothing less than to be watching God at work. And human history lends weight to the centurion's verdict. Somebody once put it like this: he was born in an obscure village, the child of a simple woman. He worked in a carpentry shop until he was 30, and then for 3 years he was an itinerant preacher. When the tide of popular opinion turned against him, his friends ran away. He was turned over to his enemies. He was tried and convicted. He was nailed to a cross and strung up between two thieves. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never owned a home. He never went to college. He never traveled more than 200 miles from the place where he was born. He never did any of the things that are usually associated with greatness. Yet all the armies that ever marched, and all the governments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned, have not affected the course of human history as has that one solitary life. So come back with me for a moment to the gospel records, to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Look with me at the baby in the manger and ask, who is this child whose simple birth causes such a stir that King Herod tries to have him killed, while wise men, astrologers probably rather than kings, come from far away offering him their homage and their gifts? And then look at the young man in his prime. Listen to him and his teaching. Watch him as the ordinary folk hang on his every sentence. And ask yourself, as people did at the time, who is this extraordinary teacher whose recorded words still reverberate around the world 2,000 years after his coming? And then look with the centurion at the cross on which he died. Now, that God the Creator should be born into his own world, which is, of course, the Christian claim, that he should live in that world as a man, is remarkable enough. But that this Son of God should then die and head to his death both willingly and deliberately, that is truly astonishing. And it cries out for an explanation. Look at the manger, listen to the teacher, gaze at the cross, and look too at the empty tomb. The tomb he left behind when he was raised bodily, triumphantly, from the dead. The evidence for that is remarkably strong. Alan Johns, whom we listened to just now, stands in a long line of legal opinion which has examined the evidence in depth and found it to be overwhelmingly persuasive. But laying the issue of evidence on one side for a moment, if it is true that in the person of Jesus we are dealing with God himself, is it then really so hard to believe that he would turn out to be stronger than death? It might actually be harder to believe that death could ever have held him in the first place. And in the context of everything else that he was and said and did, the resurrection of Jesus makes perfect sense. Which would not be true, say, of the resurrection of Queen Victoria. I mean, imagine if after her death, Queen Victoria had been seen alive under the clock at Waterloo Station, or perhaps chatting with her Prime Minister in the garden of Buckingham Palace. That would not only have been very surprising at first, it would still be very surprising today. Totally and inexplicably bizarre. And not surprisingly, no one, as far as I know, has ever suggested that it took place. Whereas every New Testament document shouts out loud, and Christian experience confirms it, that Jesus is risen from the dead. Which takes to another level altogether the spontaneous testimony of the centurion. This man really was the Son of God. Well, says somebody thoughtfully, that is interesting in its own way, but I don't really see what it's got to do with me. I mean, his coming doesn't seem to have made a lot of difference to our world, to be honest. It seems to go on much as it always has. The news I watch on my television is disturbing, if not harrowing. I don't see much sign of this much vaunted peace on earth or goodwill among men. So if it's your thing, then that's fine by me and I'm happy for you. But please forgive me if I remain just a bit skeptical about the whole thing. How does a Christian reply to that? What is the significance of Jesus' coming? Well, the angel song of peace on earth is really only half the story, and it's easily misunderstood in any case. Jesus actually said on one occasion that we should not think he had come to bring peace on earth, but rather division and a sword, and I have yet to see that on a Christmas card. So we do well to listen to what John goes on to say, which is not only that the Son of God has come, but that he has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true. In other words, because Jesus has come, we can understand things that we could never have known otherwise and could never have worked out for ourselves. We can know why we're here. We can know the purpose of life. A few months ago, I took our 13-year-old cat to the vet. Our vet is a very pleasant guy. He clearly knows his trade. He thinks well of our cat, and he doesn't pretend to be a Christian. He must somehow have worked out that I'm a vicar. I don't think I ever told him, but he must have worked it out somehow, because having prescribed a course of treatment for the cat, he fixed me with a beady eye and declared with a firm voice that this regime must be followed religiously. To which my reply is, well, I'll do the best I can for the cat, but I'm not really a religious person. It surprises people to be told that, but it is true. I have never been particularly interested in religion or religions. But then Christianity, rightly understood, isn't really a religion at all. It is a revelation. The God who is there, who has been there all the time, and whom we might not have known otherwise, has revealed himself, has made himself known to us in Jesus Christ. And in Jesus Christ, he invites us to come to know him. And when the vet tells me to follow this regime religiously, you know, I can almost feel the burden of it land on my shoulders. Religion is generally such a burdensome business. But Jesus didn't come to add to our burdens. He came to take them away. Especially that burden of our guilt, our moral failures, our seeming inability to be the people we ought to be. The Son of God has come. He gave his life to take those burdens away. We didn't ask him to, and if we are honest, we might not have wanted him to. But he came anyway, and he has brought us understanding that we may know him who is true. In the series of broadcasts I referred to earlier, Will Self could find no satisfactory answer to his question, what is the purpose of life? He was no wiser at the end of episode 3 than he had been at the beginning of episode 1. And in his conclusion, he quoted with approval a passerby he'd spoken to. This passerby had replied, well, it's best just to accept that there isn't any meaning. Life is just a happy accident. There is no meaning to be found. And when you realize that, the life you live can perhaps be slightly more fulfilling. Really? A happy accident? Alan de Botton, one of the philosophers Will Self interviewed, set out his stall rather more eloquently. I quote, "My own philosophy," he said, "is a background sense of depression, which is unarguable and true, but mixed with an intense pragmatism about what we might achieve today. We are erecting matchsticks on the seashore. They will be wiped away. And the best we can do is just arrange those matchsticks in as humane and interesting a way as possible." Well, if we'd been left to ourselves, that might well be the best we could do, but we haven't. So we can do better than that. In fact, we must do better than that, because you and I have received a summons. The Son of God has come and has given us understanding that we may know him who is true. And in our post-truth world, Jesus Christ remains true. And he invites us to respond to him in simple but total trust and obedience. And none of us will ever find life's meaning, or indeed find ourselves, until we have first been found by him.